My name is Dan Seidel. Thank you for coming this afternoon. The title of my talk is Death and Life in the Artist's Studio. What I'm going to present to you is my intimate experience with an artist that I've worked with for a number of years. And how I'm going to present this to you is I'm going to let the work itself in many ways speak to you. We do a lot of theologizing and a lot of explaining and a lot of interpreting when we are thinking about how the gospel connects to culture. And one of the things that art does is it forces us, if only for a moment, to be passive and receptive and to shut up. And that's not a posture we like very much. And the temptation in a presentation like this is to show you slides and begin to interpret the work and begin to explain it and begin to surround it and cloak it with all kinds of words that do all kinds of wonderful things, but don't let the work itself, the story perhaps, as Sally mentioned this morning, speak to you. The work that I'm going to present is work that I'm continuing to rethink and to think through theologically. I feel that this work in particular opens up a particularly provocative theological space to reflect. But I'm not exactly certain how and in what way it opens it up. So there are a lot of rough edges and a lot of contradictions and a lot of unfinished sentences that I'm just going to leave out there for you. And I'd like you, perhaps, in our question and answer, in our discussion, to be able to think with me and help me through this. So in some ways, I'm workshopping my approach to painting in general, and this artist's work in particular. One of the things I'm very much interested in is not the theological content of a painting or the religious content of a painting, the subject matter of a painting. What I'm interested in is what happens when a painting confronts a viewer and the theological space that opens up when a viewer is actually confronted by a work of art and confronted by painting. And how that particular relationship is one, as I've mentioned, for a moment perhaps, is passive and receptive. And how often, as viewers, we fight that. We fight it by interpreting it. We fight it by dismissing it or celebrating or embracing it. But one of the things we don't do is listen to it and allow it to do something to us. When we think about art, we have to think about the particular kind of pressure that an artist deals with. And this particular kind of pressure is this. The artist spends his or her life making paintings. For example, smearing oil paint on a scrap of canvas. Devoting their entire life for the moment, for the week, for the month, for the year, for an exhibition. And present the work to viewers. Their audience for this exhibition are those men and women who have finished a day's work, who are going to an opening, who are done doing the hard work of the day. Big boy work, big girl work, loosening the ties, finding a drink and something to eat, and it's a nice meeting ground, a place to relax, to soften the rough edges before they go on out and continue their evening, go to a movie or a theater show or to dinner. So the artist labors, sacrifices to put these artifacts out into the world. And their most visible and most necessary audience are those for whom art is entertainment and relaxation. And so those are the people who will buy the work. Those are the people that will keep the studio's lights on. Those are the people for whom art is relaxation, entertainment, a means of access to other kinds of social and cultural milieu and activity. Those are the people for whom the artist depends. Yet those are the people for whom the artist's work is not communicating, speaking. And the artist recognizes this. The artist that I've worked with for over 20 years recognizes this in some way, that this is an asymmetrical relationship, that the work that they send out are not powerful, celebratory things. They're weak and they're vulnerable, even though we attach so much value to them. We see that these artists are celebrating their creativity, their individuality, their life. Perhaps from a theological perspective, we may say they're celebrating the creation and a certain kind of creational theology that might be operative. Yet last year, last May, when Sotheby's put Edvard Munch's painting, it's a drawing, pastel, at auction, and it fetched $120 million. The most ever paid for a work of art. I happened upon this photograph. And it's a photograph of Tobias Meyer. He's a swashbuckling, suave German auctioneer, an all-star in the art world, who bid up the price of this work to $120 million. And that photograph revealed something that I hadn't considered before, and that is how confident he was as he was leveraging and bartering all of the people out in the audience who were looking to justify themselves in this work. And look at that painting and how tiny and small and insignificant it seems. You've often had, and you may have had this experience. I had this experience a lot. I have an idea that I'm going to go see a certain painting or a certain work of art that I'm really interested in. Maybe I've seen it in production, I've heard it talked about, et cetera, et cetera. I know I should love it, and I know there's going to be some sort of mind-blowing experience. So I go to the museum, and I see the work, and I'm underwhelmed. Wait, the work doesn't do anything to me. It's supposed to strike me, and I'm supposed to fall on the ground, and start quivering and shaking. But the heavens are supposed to open up. But it doesn't do that. And I began thinking about that. I've been thinking about why I'm always underwhelmed. And it seems that I operate with certain presumptions about what the work is going to do for me. Something perhaps we could put within the context of theology of glory. It's the good, the true, the beautiful, the powerful. Yet I'm wondering if painting doesn't operate, art in general, painting in particular in this case, and maybe even modern art, in the framework of the theology of the cross. Weakness, poverty, insecurity. And certainly this man, Edvard Munch, who painted this work, is not celebrating culture. He's not celebrating the world. He is reacting to it as given to him and forced upon him. Yet the work itself becomes means by which a New York businessman here in town can justify himself in a particularly culturally context. And it's on view at the Museum of Modern Art. And the Museum of Modern Art is working very hard to get him to gift it to the museum, so they're doing all they can to focus on this work. And so the artist operates in that milieu, a milieu in which the audience, to keep the lights on in the studio, is one in which that audience isn't listening to the work. Yet there is an audience out there somewhere for whom the work will speak. But what does that work say? And how does that artist, and why does that artist continue to make work in this context? The artist I'm going to talk about is an artist I've worked with for about 12 years. His name is Enrique Martinez Celaya. He paints landscapes, figurative work, has a studio in Miami. And I haven't worked with him for over a year, and I have found myself, as I'm reflecting and thinking through theologically my approach to culture and my approach to painting, I have been using, chewing on, rethinking, meditating upon my experience with him. Things he's said, what I've observed, how I've thought and experienced and felt my experience in working with him. And that is what I want to share, what I want to share with you. We often think about artists as behaving very oddly and weirdly, strangely. Damien Hirst or Andy Warhol or some of these artists that have a certain behavior that we see as marginalized. But what I've become very much interested in is investigating that and asking the question how similar they are to us and how they're defending, shaping, strengthening the context in which these vulnerable objects get sent out into the world. And they do so by behaving oddly, by playing roles, by doing strange things, acting as if they don't care, like Andy Warhol, for example. Pretending to be a bad boy and a partier and a friend of rock stars and actors like Damien Hirst. Behavior that we would marginalize and say, well, that's not how we act. But quite frankly, what we have to recognize is we produce vulnerable things. We send vulnerable things out into the world, and we're nervous about that. And we don't know how they're going to be received. And we defend it, and we shape it, and we play certain roles, and we wear certain masks. So I want you to think about this as I show you some of these images as I talk about his work. This is a studio in downtown Miami in the Design District, Wynwood Arts District. It's 20,000 square feet. The studio is called Whale and Star, named after Melville's novel Moby Dick, which was influential to him as he was learning English. He read Moby Dick, and it was helping him understand the language. He and I often referred to it as the Pequod. And as you know, the destiny of the Pequod is that it sinks and is destroyed. The studio functioned as a fortress, as a protection, as a warehouse, castle, fortress within which these vulnerable objects were produced. So I thought about the studio as the Pequod going on a search for something that would destroy it. And the question that Enrique would ask me is, when it's over, will you write the story? Who will write the story of the end? And in many ways, the studio, and I've thought about it over the past 12 to 13 months, operates as a mausoleum. There is a certain sense in which this artist was already dead and understood his work having an audience after his death. This is the library that greets you when you go into the studio. It gives a sense that the studio is an archive, is a research center, is a place of contemplation and reflection. The studio also operated as a foundation. It's a place that will be a foundation after he dies. And we talk openly about that. One of my roles would be is the director of the foundation. From the very beginning, as an artist, he was teaching at Pomona College, was actually a colleague, faculty mate of David Foster Wallace. While he was teaching at Pomona College and beginning to make his work and to begin to sell it, he was developing a family collection. And that family collection was there for the sole purpose of giving it to his children. And so the studio space, this image, I apologize for the poor quality. The image, this is an exhibition space of his family collection that he presented as his family collection, as his legacy. And this painting here of a large burning bush, I'd like to spend a little time looking at. It's called The Burning, Mandelstam. Mandelstam is a poet that Martina Salai is very interested in. If you know him, he was working in the 20s and 30s. He was pursued by Stalin. He was ultimately imprisoned and killed. So you have a painting made out of tar and feathers, materials of debasement and degradation, of death. There is a bird coming out of this bush that is aflame. And in the lower left-hand corner, scratched on the surface, is simply the name Mandelstam, written like an inmate or a convict or a prisoner or a person caught in a space with scroll on the wall. It was also the source of another work, a photograph in which he used his daughter as a model, and he used a transferable tattoo of Mandelstam on her back. What you don't see in this image, unfortunately, is her birthmark here. And that birthmark was one of 12, I think, that she had when she was born, the first child. Those birthmarks are indicators of a possible degenerative disease that could potentially have been very serious. It turned out not to be that disease, but she bears those birthmarks. And so the pairing of the birthmark with Mandelstam's photograph that was taken at his arrest, he wanted to put together, have the impending death of his daughter, the impending death of Mandelstam. Mandelstam himself also conceived of the audience for his poetry in a way that I think is quite interesting to think about, and that audience is one that happens upon the poem. Mandelstam said a poem is writing a message in a bottle, putting it in the bottle and sending it out into the ocean. You happen upon it from the beach, you open up that bottle and you read that note, and you are the audience for that poem. You are the addressee, as he calls it. So the idea that the work of art is actually searching out and finding a reader, finding a viewer in the future, I think is a very rich theological theme, one in which, especially thinking about art not as a way of proving one's worthiness to God or ascending the ladder to God or as a way of participating in a certain kind of spiritual devotion to God, but as a means of loving your neighbor. The idea that a work of art aspires to an audience, aspires to a neighbor to love through poetry, through painting. The Russian poet Joseph Brodsky, in an essay on Mandelstam, said that Mandelstam wrote a 15-line death sentence, and that was wherein he was critical of Stalin. He poked fun at him, and from that moment on, Stalin was pursuing him. So this is a photograph that Enrique used. This is the cover of a book. Wayland Starr is also an imprint, a small imprint. It publishes books of poetry and art criticism, etc. And one of the publications is a selection of translations of Mandelstam's work. And Mandelstam himself said the Russians take their poets seriously. They shoot them. So you think, geez, lots of death here, right? Isn't art supposed to be fun? Isn't that what collectors and you go to art galleries and you do those? That's part of the enjoyment. And talking about death and thinking about death is such a buzzkill. But it also draws a distinction between how the artists themselves feel their work and how many in the community or how many viewers, audience members receive it. This is a painting that was painted with blood. On the left, it's a diptych, it's a two-panel painting. So on the left is a painting, it's painted in blood. It depicts, it looks like a lightning strike coming through the sky, dusk sky, reddish brown sky, and a mirror. And this particular work was on view in an exhibition at the Museum of Biblical Art here in the city a couple years ago. And that mirror couldn't get in the building, and it was too heavy, and it created all kinds of problems. So the decision was made simply to show the painting. And he and I were talking about that problem, and he said, you know, it's not that big a deal. The collector was having a bit of a problem with it. The collector had lent it from his collection in Aspen, Colorado. He was having a bit of a problem with it, but Enrique said, you know, it doesn't really matter in terms of the integrity of the painting because I paint all paintings and to function as it is. There's always one panel that looks back at you as a painter and looks at you as a viewer. So the question of the gaze of the painting actually has some agency that actually does something to you. It's not an artifact to be interpreted, to be exegeted, to be explained, and otherwise read, but it's something that actually has a kind of agency that moves to you. This is a particular painting, one of my favorite paintings. It's called Sea and Snow. It's a very strange painting in which this boy has a winter coat standing at the beach, and flakes of snow are coming down. So you have a collision of cultures in some way, in climates. And that boy's look is disturbing. I worked very hard to try to place that painting with collectors, and none of the collectors wanted it in their home. None of them wanted to be gazed at by this painting, by this figure, by this boy. And it brought to mind Rilke's famous poem, The Archaic Torso of Apollo, in which the narrator in the poem happens upon this Greek statue, and this marble statue speaks, and what it says to the narrator is, you must change your life. The question is, what is that? Is that law? Is that gospel? That address, that personal address, not the world sucks, the world's great, but you, that this painting stands, or this sculpture, this poem stands before you, and you are the one that it addresses at that moment. You are the audience. And so, standing before a painting, it exists for me, and it makes me accountable in some way. And I'm wondering, thinking about what that way is, and I'm thinking about the fact that as human beings, we are distracted creatures. We struggle with regret in the past. We struggle with aspirations for the future. We seem to live everywhere but the present. And a painting does something. A work of art does something. It seems to make real that space that opens up as the present. And I'm wondering if the claim that that work of art makes on that narrator in Rilke's poem, you must change your life, is what is heard in the present. Martina Slay is very interested, has been very interested in religion. And this is a view of his workshop area where he's making work. These are 3 of 4 paintings that he exhibited at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. In the fall of 2010, one depicts a boy embracing a horse that's taken from his reflection on the story of Nietzsche's breakdown, where apparently he sees a man beating a horse and rushes up to that horse and embraces it. There's a snowy, muddy path, and then a subject that has continued to interest him, a boy on crutches, with what begins to see something around his neck, and what will come in, what he will paint behind this boy's head is a house. And this house hangs on the back of his head that he struggles with on his crutches. Here's that painting in the cathedral. And for Martina Slay, he wasn't interested in any kind of spiritual content of the work, or that it was transcendent, or any of that interest. What he was interested in is the effect of the viewer. When you go to a museum, or you go to a gallery, you're trained to put aside your stuff, your cares. You have a hard day at work, difficult stuff, I'm not going to go home yet, so I'm going to go to the gallery, I'm going to go to the museum, and you leave that stuff outside the museum, the gallery space, and you are trained, we think about it, we experience going to look at a work of art, and we leave all of that behind. We look at it aesthetically. We look at the beauty in the work, etc. Yep, what he was interested in is the cathedral as a space in which people are trained to bring all of their stuff in. And how does a painting operate when a viewer is bringing all their stuff in? How does, as he had talked about it, how does a mother feel when her son is in Afghanistan, when she finds out her son has gone back into drug rehab? How does that painting affect her, and how does it stand up against all that she's dealing with? And so the church context was a context in which the painting was going up against all of the stuff that art people are trained to put aside. So it became a way to test the painting. Is the painting effective? Does it actually do what artists and critics have claimed for it for hundreds of years? Feeding the soul, nourishing the soul, all of those things. Well, what does it do? How does it function? This is a painting, an example of a painting. It's called The Rose, that came out of his reflection on a particular fairy tale, children's story, one of Grimm's fairy tales. I'm going to read to you. And when he was making this work and this body of work, this is another space in the studio, another workspace, he would read this over and over throughout the day. Once there was a poor woman who had two children. The youngest one had to go into the forest every day to fetch wood. Once when he had gone a very long way to find wood, a child who was very little but very strong came to him and helped him gather the wood and carried it to his house. But then in the wink of an eye, he disappeared. The child told his mother about this, but she did not believe him. Finally, the child brought a rose and said that the beautiful child had given it to him, and that when the rose was in full blossom, he would come again. The mother placed the rose into water. One morning, the child did not get up. The mother went to his bed and found him lying there dead. On that same morning, the rose came into full blossom. The question that he asked, would continue to ask me, was who is this boy, this other boy? Where did this other boy come from? In this story, the perception was, or the sense that you get, is that these boys knew each other. That the mother knew this boy. Where does this boy come from? And the sense of operating from a child's perspective on the world was something that he was very much interested in. And the work that he had was deeply affected by the birth of his children. He has four children, and each of those, the births of those children, forced him to think about his own mortality again and again. This is a project. I did two projects with him at the museum I worked at. This is the second one that we did. It was a project called Coming Home, and it was a restaging of an installation that he had done a few years earlier. It features a boy confronting an elk made of tar and feathers and wire. And he wanted to create the sense that these figures were barely pulled off, a sense that there's an awkwardness, a sense they're barely completed, or a sense they were going to fall apart at any moment. We blew up a photograph that he had not had developed and made it into a wallpaper. And so it encircled the space. We have photographs. He had taken photographs of these figures in the forest in Southern California and at the shore, so you can see the figure standing on the shore at the Pacific Ocean. Here's a close-up. What is between the antlers is a mirror. And the boy confronting this gigantic elk is also confronted with his reflection. And this question, this issue of the quorum relationship. We stand before the face of the other. We stand before the face of God. We stand before ourselves as well. And that art seems to activate this quorum relationship. That in standing before a painting, we realize that we do conduct our lives standing before the face of something, of someone. But what I really want to spend some time looking at is this project called Schneebed, Snowbed. It's a project that Martina Celaya exhibited first at the Berlin Philharmonic in 2004. It was presented again in Leipzig in 2006 and then at the Mayan Art Museum in 2011. What it is a meditation on Beethoven's deathbed. He uses this word Schneebed as an adaptation of a poem by Paul Celan. Celan wrote in German, wrote as a survivor of the Holocaust, was writing poetry that Adorno responded to famously when he said it is barbaric to write poetry after Auschwitz. What the installation features is two rooms. A room with a bed and a painting. An entranceway blocked by birch trees. And a chair in the other room, which I will show you in a little bit. It's an icon of Paul Celan. Martina Celaya would often paint little icons of figures, poets, philosophers, painters that he was looking at and thinking about. So one of the things that's interesting about this deathbed, in which he reflects on Beethoven's long convalescence. Beethoven is on his deathbed in Vienna, spends months and months there. People come from all over the world, and he's functioning as a living relic. People will come, they'll clip part of his hair. And what Martina Celaya was interested in was, what was Beethoven thinking about laying on that deathbed, looking back on his life? And here's the chair. And that chair is for us. So in the installation, you are invited to sit in that chair and look at the distance this bed. Now, what is interesting about this bed is that it's frozen. It's made of bronze, cast of bronze. It is rigged with pipes. And those pipes are frozen by a compressor. And that compressor freezes the pipes, and the bronze gets a sheen of ice. Depending on how cold the space is, the ice can really turn flaky into snow. Needless to say, it's harder to do that in Miami than it is to do it in Berlin. So what you have is this compressor making a noise. And I want to show you, and go back to this detail. What you see underneath the bed are these two pipes. And that is the cold vapor that is coming in underneath the bronze bed. And the pipes are under here, and that's how it freezes. It makes a noise, it hums. And so you have this very strange sensation of a deathbed being kept alive by this machine that viewers see. It's humming and working. It should be on in a minute here. What I want to do is I want to read to you selections of Martina Celaya's lecture that he gave.
You jiggled something.
I know.
It may be the cord for
me. I'm going to read to you selections from the lecture that he gave at the Miami Art Museum. Schneebed is not a treatise on the Enlightenment. Schneebed is not a treatise on the Enlightenment, Beethoven, or, in my view, death. It is rather a meditation on the loneliness and sacrifices that often accompany greatness. The hollowing of status and prestige of death, and the hope for redemption that usually comes with it. I'm going to try this again. When I was younger, I would have argued the justification for our effort was self-knowledge. Now I know the best reason is death itself. In the case of Beethoven, the contrast between his prophetic work and the lump of bodily concerns and elusive heart wounds that define the end of his life is not only difficult to reconcile, but raises for me a haunting question. Can the duties we have to our dreams be reconciled with the hopes and responsibilities of daily living? And this in turn leads to another also perplexing question. What is worth doing? Okay, this is right.
Dan, you jiggled that cord.
Yeah.
I think that's where the problem came. Do you want me to get the tech?
There we go. This is a detail of the painting. The painting is made of tarn feathers. It's a painting that Martina Szilágyi thought about as the view that Beethoven was looking at. And the view is the forest in Bonn, which is where he was born. Not born in Vienna, dying in Vienna, thinking about his childhood, thinking about his birthplace in Bonn. And so looking out into this forest. And it's a view that we see and we experience as well. Also, when it was first presented in the Berlin Philharmonie, you could hear the echoes of Beethoven's music. So the installation was open during the performance of the cycles of Beethoven's Lake Quartets. And so you could actually hear some of the music. You hear the sound, the humming of this machine that's keeping this deathbed alive. Here's a line to get into the installation. The problem with the installation is to go out one person at a time. You don't have the phenomenon that you have if you go to MoMA and see the Munch painting, where everybody's gathering around it and people are trying to take photographs of it. It's only one person at a time, and you are that person. And so you have the experience of all of this work, all of the effort to keep this thing frozen that the artist made at that moment is for you. And so you ask this question, perhaps. So the question of what is worth doing, and whether Beethoven regretted anything, and whether his music measured up to his personal life, and whether it was worth the sacrifice. So the question of worth, was it worth it? Although the title, Martina Szilágyi says, points toward the bed, what mattered most to me while making this work was how a death room might remember itself, since it is the room and not the bed or the dying that holds the memory of all regrets and all promises. It is also in that last universe of the room where redemption can perhaps be found. And then in answering the question, what Schneebett is? Schneebett is not a work of something, but of nothing, of absence. Without the refrigeration, the snowbed would melt. This life-giving, life-keeping aspect of hoses and machines is important to the experience of the work, as is the risk of failure. The glycol water mixture has to run near the point of complete freezing, and the compressor has to be pushed to near fatigue for the bed to remain frozen. This disrupting and monotonous sound of the machines is my crude way to insert the maddening rushing and roaring sounds Beethoven heard, despite his deafness, into your experience of the work. The machine sound is an insistent reminder of the absence of music. have mercy. What Martina Celaya seems to make explicitly clear in his own work, but also it seems to be operative in different degrees with just about every artist that I've worked with, is that death is the focal point of the work. Whether making work that's going to live beyond them, whether the recognition that every work that they produce outside the studio is in fact a failure, that it doesn't do what they want it to do, or the question of not being able to achieve again what they thought they might have achieved in the past, the last painting that they painted. The question of, is it worth it, and the value of what they were doing. In Jim Jarmusch's movie, Dead Man, made in the mid-1990s, how many of you guys have seen it? Johnny Depp plays this man named William Blake. And William Blake encounters a Native American named Nobody. And Nobody asks him his name. And Johnny Depp says, William Blake. And Nobody says, are you serious? You're William Blake? He says, then you are a dead man. And it seems to me that the evolution or the development of this movie is really in many ways an allegory of the artistic persona, of recognizing in many ways that the artist is truly a dead man. A few years after Martina Celaya made the installation called Schneebe, he was working on a sculpture and had a tragic accident. In June of 2008, I cut my hand with a chainsaw while carving the sculpture, The Rail. The reconstruction required 120 stitches. The morning after surgery, a question came to mind that I have since heard many times from other people. Was it worth it? What the question, was it worth it, is probably really asking is whether I can conceive of a world in which art can justify sacrifice. A question that has its roots in our cynicism. I finished The Rail with a bandaged hand and with the help of one of my assistants, and then I burnt it. Now I see it every day in my studio. As I pass by it, 8 out of 10 times, I say to myself, yes, it was worth it. The other 2 times, I wish I would have risked more. Seems to me, as I look back on my experience working with Enrique Martinez Celaya, that his work comes out of a profound sense, not just of death, but of a desire in some way to be killed, to die, and a death that he cannot affect. He told me when his hand was cut and parts of his fingers were laying around on the studio floor that the assistants that was working were passing out and blood was spewing, that as he thought, as things were going in slow motion, as he was thinking about where his work would go when he died. Not about his wife, not about his children, but about what would happen to the work. A German artist, whom Martina Celaya has a very close and combative relationship to. His name is Anselm Kiefer. He said something in an interview that I have found very interesting and something I've been spending some time thinking about. Kiefer was responded Kiefer was asked by a critic, a lot of people think your work is quite beautiful. What do you think about that? And Kiefer, whose work is defined by working through the Nazi past, going through German imagery, dealing with all these taboo images that that were violating the post-war German silence on anything that smacked of the spiritual, anything that smacked of the Germanic. And Kiefer said, pointing to a painting, said, I spent 5 years on this painting. And it seems to me that the conclusion that it's beautiful just doesn't seem to satisfy me. And he said, you know what beautiful is? It is beautiful to be justified. And it seems to me that if art doesn't save us, if art doesn't save the artist, that perhaps the better way to look at it and to think about it, for us who interact with artists, who look at art and take art seriously, who are thinking about the operation of grace, law and grace in the world, is that what the artist is looking for, yearning for, is to be killed, to die first. For Enrique, it talks about redemption, salvation in some ways, but he always talks about it after death. And so perhaps as we think about art, and we think about it from a pastoral standpoint, we think about it from a practitioner standpoint, we think about it as simply a receiver and an enjoyer standpoint, that what is going on in the art studio is a desire not just to make things, but to have something made of them. And so perhaps the focal point is that we come to realize, that they come to realize, the work that they're producing is an embodiment of a desire to be killed, and only to be killed. And to be killed is the only way that one can rise again and have redemption. And that is truly beautiful. Thank you. I try to write weekly at a blog that's hosted by Pathios, and I work out some of these issues. So if you're interested, you can follow me on Twitter and you can follow my blog there. Hope we have time for a couple of questions, and if you have some questions, please throw them out there. I apologize for the imagery. One thing that an art historian wants is great images, so if the lecture and the words around it suck, at least you've seen the work. So it kind of half happens. Yes, ma'am.
There was an article some years back in Esquire magazine called The Four Brushmen of the Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. It was during the 80s. You probably are familiar with it, but there was a discussion between, I believe it was Longo, with his dealers, Helene Weiner and Arlene, Metro Pictures. And he said, I want to die, because if I die, my paintings will be worth something, and I'll become famous and have value. And Arlene said, I'm sorry, that won't happen. You haven't made enough work yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly a problem. The focus on death in the artist studio is a buzzkill to dealers and collectors who make their livings selling work to people who are denying their death, while the ones who are making the work are dealing with the reality of their death in a way that other cultural practices work very hard to undermine or to soften or to dismiss. But artists, in my experience, artists deal with it on a daily basis in terms of the value of their work, recognizing that the work's value is peripheral, that these works, as I've mentioned, are weakened vulnerable. And that reveals their weakness and their vulnerability. And in fact, often the hyperbole and the rhetoric that comes out of artist studios, what is often defined modernism in terms of paintings changing the world and works of art transforming society, have come out of response to the reality of the weakness of these works, not out of a testimony of their strength. The abstract expressionist painter Mark Rothko said it's a risky business to send a painting out into the world. And this is an artist that committed suicide when he was 70, at the height of his fame and money and comfort. Another question? Yes?
I'm going to risk this, but I have a friend who, and I think also a friend who tells me that he wakes up in the middle of the night pretty regularly in like a panic attack, thinking about death. And he told me that he has sworn to himself that I will never have children because I never want to put them through the existential fear that I feel in those moments. And I think about that when he tells me, and then when I was raised a Christian, and I've always had hope in the resurrection of the dead, and I'm grateful for that hope, but it's made me wonder, or I guess I'll ask you, do you think that Christians can oftentimes, or I don't know if I'm going to witness well, deal with it what you will, but because we just seem not to take death all that seriously at times, it's maybe you could say it's like an over spiritualization,
Well, I think you're right. I think the resistance of the preaching of the law and the gospel, God's two words, the resistance in the evangelical world, is in many ways a manifestation of that. That the resistance of being killed first, of the reality of baptism as a killing, as a death, and then resurrection, I think is something that we often, well, we as human beings resist, and we don't want to be killed. And so I think that artists deal with it in a particular way. They deal with it in a particularly profound way that they may not intuit. What is remarkable about Martinus' life is on the surface. And there's a part of me that feels like he had a family in order to have a legacy, in order to have people that his collection can go to. That's dealing with death openly and honestly in a way that is quite remarkable. And the fact that for Kiefer, art isn't doing the justifying. That justification has to come from outside, somewhere else. And there's something about the recognition that something has to be done to you from the outside.
Could you
killed
give us the poem
and resurrected.
Again, the
yes,
quote
ma'am.
Again from Kiefer, Anselm Kiefer.
What about I should?
Would you repeat the
quote?
Because that was really, really
interesting. Yeah. Said, it is beautiful. It is beautiful to be justified.
It is beautiful to be justified. Can you unpack that a little bit more, what you think he was?
I think it's responding to a human need, the human desire that we have to be saved. Something has to be done to us. That our justification as human beings is predicated not on what we can do, but comes outside of us. Yes, ma'am.
Bouncing off of that, are you also saying that these artists are seeking to justify themselves through their work and thus dying under the fact that the art is like functioning like the law to them and unable to completely grasp
Yeah, I think so. I mean, on one hand, I mean, that's why how I'm trying to think through the viewer's response to the work as a certain kind of killing, something that's being done to us, where we talk about art being beauty and it's putting Christmas lights around a tree, or it's adding fudge to the ice cream, you know, or whipped cream to the brownie, but that just covers things up. And what art is doing and can do, the service that it can provide, can be first and foremost to kill in order to be able to create a space for being made new. The question, though, that I still struggle with, and I'm struggling with it actively, is within this context of weight and death, unbearable burden that Martina Stelaya was working on, the paintings that he was producing, for example, open up space in some sort of way that I don't really know if it's grace, or if it's a potential for grace, or if it's an echo of grace, or if it's simply a promise of something, an inarticulate hope, and yet, given all of this, where is the hope? The question that the ironic title of my talk is Death and Life. The question is, where is life? Is it life in simply doing it? Is it life in the desire to find it? Is it desire in producing objects that on one level seem to say something? So it seems to me that every work of art that's made, poem, painting, etc., if we think about it from Mandelstam's context, is searching for the audience, and that the primary audience, the ideal audience, is the one that confesses Colossians 1, that in whom all things hold together. That's the ideal audience, it seems. Even for a maker who doesn't believe it, the work seems to believe it. And that also is an interesting component of the dynamic of art making, in which the artwork can speak in a voice that's different than the artist. Always thought about it. I've always thought about how this artist, as an atheist, as an avowed atheist, he may say that he's an atheist, but the works are not atheistic artifacts. They do something else. But what is that something else that's being done? And it seems to me, in the context of the good, the true, the beautiful, the fact that these works help us, or the art is supposed to help us find heroes and virtuous actions to imitate, isn't where thinking theologically about art should go. That really it should go, it should come out of this sense of death. That somehow and in some way, a work of art, its power, its effectiveness, is a killing of some kind that's being done to us. And we embody our passivity and receptivity as human beings when we encounter a work of art. You know, Kant wants to see it in certain kinds of ways, and so, but he's trying to get at what is happening to him. If the work is doing something to him. And it seems all of criticism, great art criticism, literary criticism, comes out of that. We're trying to struggle with the fact that something's been opened up. And that what that has been opened up is doing something to that viewer, in which the viewer, the reader, isn't the subject of their sentences. I mean, one of the things that what Rilke's poem emphasizes is, you're not the subject of your life. There's somebody else for whom you give an account. And that is some aspect that, despite Martina Stelaya's atheism, what makes his approach so provocative is that there is a recognition that he is being, something is being done to him. And he is making preparations for it. Being done to him. Any other comments or questions? All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.